How much of an impact do you think the selling of that term for that area again, Ladies Mile, had on the campaign?
Say that again.
Sorry.
I think this sort of came from Tony Wood. He mentioned something about coining or selling the term Ladies Mile.
Yeah,
to the press, and I guess the media in general. So I was just wondering what
it has
impact you thought that had.
It's really, I think, been a bit of a diversion, because the real estate people still call it the Flatiron District. There is no Flatiron District, uppercase D. But it takes advantage of the name of the most famous building in the area. And it provides an alternative that's more recognizable to the public at large than Ladies Mile is, which requires some explanation.
Right.
So they don't really market it as such.
Was it marketed to developers and like landlords as a Ladies Mile? Like, was the history of the area really pushed to those interests?
To the extent that the rezoning makes it easy for residential, or easier to construct new residential buildings without having to go through a tortuous special permit process. I don't know. I'm not that much of a market person, but I don't think that the coinage Ladies Mile Historic District is one that's helpful, if that's what you're implying, to current sales.
Well, or more in terms of the campaign, like giving it that, I guess that flavor, that sense of history is.
Well, they know when they move in what they're getting into, and it's called Ladies Mile because they have to go to the landmark screen for exterior work. But I wouldn't say it's something they, a magnet, shall we say. I think the real estate industry's coinage, unfortunately, is more descriptive, simply because of the name Clutter, and more enticing. It's a good question, which I've never really parsed. Don't tell Tony.
It was, I know the efforts had gone on for quite a while. I mean, were you aware of any sort of like change in tide at any point in the campaign where it went from, you know, going downhill or with the
that
with
changed
the Times
the
article?
It wasn't an article, it was an editorial. A lot of articles, but this was editorial. The articles helped too.
Were there ever any changes in strategy as far as what advocates did to push the campaign?
Well, as I said, I think getting celebrities involved didn't hurt. Like, where is it? I think this did a lot of good. Where is it? Guess who?
Oh, Woody Allen.
And Joe Pappas mentioned and Diana Vreeland. Yeah, we did get some famous retailers' names involved.
Retailers who had agreed to
that
like the idea of designation that you're going to come in there?
I can't really answer that. I, you know, we just of struck out in every branch we could think of, and we had an exhibition, which was mounted mainly by Bill. Turn it off. Can't remember his name. Outrageous. I need more coffee.
Would you like to take a break? Do you need a break?
No.
Okay.
Thanks. We had a wonderful exhibition, which was mounted at the Fashion Institute of Technology, which is not in Ladies' Ma, but said fashion, right?
Right.
And it was so popular, we were going to, you know, just toss it after the exhibition. We ended up moving it 5 times to different venues, including ABC Carpet, which gave half a floor to it. And by the time we moved it, we moved it to what was then the existing B. Altman store at 34th and 5th. Had it in there too before B. Altman went under. Of course, that's an individual landmark, that building, and is now occupied by public library. So it was a dog and pony show, really. by the time of our last mounting of it, it was so threadbare the boards were practically falling apart.
Wow.
Well, I think it helped a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we had lots of walking tours, which we still do once in a while. And we had all kinds of support from all the preservation groups, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things, you know,
right,
are thrown into the hopper and they help. I can't get this thing out.
This pops, flips open. So all in all, has designation achieved what you hoped for the Ladies' Mile District?
I think everybody would agree, and this is true not only of Ladies' Mile, but of every historic district. It's a constant battle. Once you've won the battle, just getting the district, that's only the beginning of the struggle. The rest of it is monitoring it, regulating it on the part of the commission. And the effort to monitor is largely up to the public, because until recently the commission didn't have the money, the budget, or the staff. So, I mean, we regularly turn in violation reports. 2 just yesterday, I think. Most of the time, it turns out they are violations. But some of it is speculative. You don't know whether it's really a violation or not. Mm-hmm. But you have to say that something looks wrong. Is it wrong? So I think it's a constant watchdog effort. And we do that. And we testify at every certificate of appropriateness hearing. And that keeps us busy.
But the overall, do you think the overall sense of place has been preserved and the overall legacy of the district?
There are some things about the new construction I could do without. And occasionally they're controversial in themselves. mainly involving rooftop additions on new construction,
mm-hmm.
and the rule of thumb. because it's okay if you can't see it from the public way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the new buildings got its comeuppance because they swore the rooftop addition would not be visible, and they built it, at least the skeleton of it, and it turned out it was eminently visible, so they had to shave off some of it. So, but I, in the main, it's gratifying that a lot of the reason for which the designation was awarded is saved, is improved, is appropriate. It's a very long program. And, you know, there are some buildings where you think it's hopeless. They'll never be brought up to snuff, even though they're designated. But sooner or later, especially involving storefronts, sooner or later somebody comes along and proposes, as they must, a design for the storefront, and the commission either approves it or improves it with our help. But it's a very long process, and now Lady's Mile is 17 years old. We had a big celebration on our 10th anniversary. And gradually, very gradually, the improvements are there. And it's doesn't happen overnight, that's for sure. You save it, then it's up to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
Any oh, here's one. One of the things that got us going, am I interrupting you? It was sort of the last draw, was the demolition on Fifth Avenue of a building that was called the Athenaeum Club. It was a private club. And it was the straw that broke the camel's back, really. Because it was a sign of the future. And that's what really got us galvanized. And the site was bought by a developer who at least was willing to talk to the public, to the neighborhood group, to us when we got organized. And I guess we were responsible for criticizing the design of his proposed new building. We certainly deserved it. But as I recall, we had two or three meetings, and we said, couldn't you at least do something with the upper reaches of this building to make it look sympathetic to a traditional building? Okay, I'll put on a mansard roof.
Oh,
so, he put on the mansard roof, and there it is. And that's the rest of it. So you win some, if you call that winning.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Peaked roof.
But most of them are, and that was true of the biggest project of all, the vacant lot at 23rd Street and 6th Avenue, which is vacant. Decades. And the struggle to put a decent building there was endless. And I'm not saying the result is perfect, but it's a lot better than it was when they made their first proposal. So it isn't just the commission who leads them into a more appropriate ways, it's also the public, if they can. You didn't ask me about Dvorak.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting to that now.
Oh, you are? Is that the end of Ladies' Vow?
I wasn't sure if we were leading into other directions or if I should go ahead with that. But, yeah,
well,
we can talk about
the Ladies'
Dvorak.
Vow packet. And here's the Lujas one. I guess
okay,
we're
great. Do you need copies of these? Or
no,
these
those are copies.
Oh, these are copies, okay. Even the letters? I can pass these on. You don't need copies made.
No, no.
Okay.
These are really well
okay.
Doing it.
Great.
That's what Vanessa said. I hope.
Yeah, oh, especially
relevant materials.
The letters and things like that, they'll be very
well,
happy.
Yeah, I didn't bring too many of them. I mean, the letters are just endless. I suppose I could have brought them all, but.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought what I brought was told the story of, I mean, I think it goes without saying almost that all of these efforts involve a lot of response from the public.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the celebrities or the elected officials or but the grassroots public. And yeah, we have a lot of those, but you know, which ones do you choose to to illustrate?
Yeah.
Well,
so
I didn't
know how
really
many letters
break
there are. I guess, you know, they could make copies or whatever. And
well, yeah, I can, sure.
Let them decide, you know, what's.
I mean, some of these people are probably dead by now. Maybe most of them.
Okay, well, getting to the Dvorak house, you know, many famous people have lived in New York City, and landmark status isn't sought for every place a famous person has lived in. So, why did you believe it was important to save the Dvorak house in particular?
Where do I start? I think the best way to start is to answer it the way Brendan Gill did. You know who Brendan Gill was?
The name sounds familiar. I'm not sure.
Well, he was a mainstay of preservationists. He was the architecture or theater critic of the New Yorker magazine. He was also an architecture critic. He was a mainstay of Municipal Art Society. And when this horrible editorial, here's the New York Times doing a horrible editorial, which posed that question exactly, the one you just asked.
Right.
And Brendan's answer in a letter to the Times this is hard to digest, so I'll just read it if I may.
Okay,
some
sure.
of it. Your editorial, Dvorak doesn't live here anymore, is a matter of protesting the designation as a historic landmark of a row house in which Antonin Dvorak lived for 3 years and in which he composed the New World Symphony. You object that the Landmarks Preservation Commission has designated the building not for its physical attributes, but as a kind of historical memory bank. What on earth is wrong with that? It is one of the duties of the commission to perform. London, Paris, Vienna, Budapest, I mean, he could have gone on, especially Prague, where Dvorak came from, have taken care to preserve just such memory banks. nearly always in the form of a house or a building that is without intrinsic architectural merit, but nevertheless evokes what our own American Henry James, speaking on this very topic, called the great lost spirits of an earlier time. Self-obliterating New York has the sorriest of records in this respect, and you propose that the record be made even worse. Dvorak doesn't live here anymore. Mozart doesn't live in Salzburg anymore. Should the house in which he lived be torn down? Should we tear down the Jumel Mansion in Manhattan? I mean, you know, the Jumel. Because Washington doesn't live in it anymore? You pretend to fear that the city will be dotted with shrines because a celebrity passed through. Is Dvorak to you merely a celebrity? Is 3 years passing through? We possess and have designated as landmarks only a handful of houses of the sort that would be cherished elsewhere and by the score. Garibaldi's house on Staten Island, Louis Armstrong's house in Queens, the house in Harlem that sheltered Langston Hughes. Your bizarre suspicion of landmarking leads you to argue that a plaque will be every bit as emotionally nourishing in New York as a building. Let me again quote Henry James, born and raised in New York City, and of whose presence scarcely a trace remains. In his book, The American Scene, James tells of returning to this country after many years of absence. He journeys down to Washington Place, just east of Washington Square, to visit the house where he was born. To his dismay, it had long since been thrown down. In its place stood a high, square, impersonal structure, proclaiming its lack of interest with a crudity all its own, and having the effect upon James of his having been amputated of half my history, as he put it. As for plaques, James says, where in fact is the point of inserting a mural tablet at any legible height in a building certain to be destroyed to make room for a skyscraper? So I think Brendan Gill struck the right chord. Mm-hmm. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah.
Sorry, I have to resort to somebody else to answer. But he's right. I mean, as the few buildings he mentioned there, Garibaldi's on Staten Island, Garibaldi lived there only 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
Langston Hughes' house in Harlem, the Negro, the black poet.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Armstrong, we all know he was a musician in Queens. He doesn't mention Edgar Allan Poe's cottage in the Bronx, which is designated. He lived there only 5 years, but he wrote Annabel Lee there, and Eureka, and some of his best work. And of course, there was the big fight with NYU over his house in Greenwich Village, where he wrote I forget what. But, you know, and they said, okay, they'd leave the facade, facadism at its worst. So, I mean, our own justification for Dvorak was, A, he was a world famous composer before he came here. He was invited here by an American millionaires to head a music conservatory that she called the National Conservatory of Music of America. She felt this country did not have its own music, and that it should have, and that what music it did have came from its indigenous population that were then called the Negroes and the American Indian, who each had their own music, but nobody knew about it. Nobody in the outer world or celebrated it. And Dvorak was famous for incorporating in his music the folk music of the Czechs and the Slovaks in his own country. So that's why this millionaire lady brought Dvorak over to head her National Conservatory of Music of America. And it was on also on 17th Street, where the house was. And it's where Washington Irving High School is now, pardon. And so this was a very far-sighted lady who was also a millionaireess and loved music. And she had in her conservatory black students, women students, which was unheard of in music at the turn of the 20th century, and American Indians, Native Americans. And so Dvorak didn't really know anything about what he faced here. Suddenly found himself with black students. He'd never even seen a black man before. And women, American Indians, Native Americans. And it was they who introduced Dvorak to their kind of music. And he was so impressed with Dvorak, brought a lot of the quotes of Dvorak. But he said that the music, the plantation songs and what were then called Negro spirituals, and the American Indian chants and dances were the fodder for a great world of music, a new world of music. So, in the compositions he wrote in this house in 17th Street, it was all his own music, his own composition, but based on what he learned from his own students. So probably the most popular symphony ever written for classical music, the New World Symphony, they're all his own themes, but they're based on the music his students exposed him to. And it seems to me, also he wrote what Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, calls the greatest piece for the cello ever written, his cello concerto for cello and orchestra, also in that house. He arranged it wasn't a spiritual, but a folk song called Old Folks at Home. He arranged it for full orchestra, soloists, and chorus, an American theme. And all of this was completely unheard of in the music world. And he did it all in this admittedly typical 19th century row house, architecturally perhaps undistinguished, but typical anyway of a period. And yes, only 3 years. And isn't this something to celebrate? Anyway, the property was in the path of another community facility, in this case a hospital.
Right, the physical.
Which had bought the building. And our problem was not so much that a hospital wanted to buy it, but what it wanted to do with it. It had just gotten a $1 million bequest from the estate of Robert Mapplethorpe, a gay
photographer.
It couldn't resist the $1 million. And that's exactly what the house, the Dvorak House was being sold for, roughly. And they wanted to put it in a worthy hospice for homeless AIDS patients. The AIDS epidemic was just really starting then. Great. Were there alternatives? Yes, plenty of them, right in the same neighborhood, right at Stuyvesant Square. A property owned by the Salvation Army, which wanted to sell it, would have been perfect. It was half block away from the hospital. There were others, but the hospital wanted that site, not so much for an AIDS hospital, but just to own it, because it was the key to getting the rest of the properties on that particular block. It was a real estate consideration more than anything. But of course, try to explain that to a public that is frightened of the AIDS epidemic. You feel almost heartless doing it. And doing it for the sake of somebody who only lived there for 3 years. It was a pure real estate deal. And nevertheless, we got it landmarked, thanks to the then chair of the commission, Laurie Beckelman. But then, this was just after the period of the new city charter, which gave the power of approving or disapproving landmark designations away from the disbanded Board of Estimate, which was declared unconstitutional, and gave the power to the city council. So for the first time, all that's in here too, the city council had the power to overturn a landmark, and they did it. Not by any means unanimous, it was a close vote. But they exercised that power, and before you could turn over, the hospital had demolished Dvorak House and started building something else. So we were handicapped, A, by this editorial, this horrible editorial, as opposed to that wonderful editorial for Ladies' Mile, and we were handicapped by the AIDS issue. Even so, at several hearings about it, we got AIDS groups, AIDS advocacy groups, to approve the landmarking to try to persuade Beth Israel Hospital to buy another property, because they claimed the Dvorak House was insufficient for treating the AIDS patients, which is true. It's too small. And even their new building is too small. So we had even some of the AIDS advocates with us and against the hospital. But don't think they didn't suffer from condemnation of their own. All because people were misled deliberately
by that editorial.
And speaking of letters, we had President Havel of Czech Republic. We had the Archbishop of Prague. We had Yo-Yo Ma. We had all, except with one horrible exception, all the great musical people on board. And
but I saw the names of a couple of people that were opposed to landmarking. That was kind of
Isaac
surprising.
Isaac Stern was one.
Itzhak Perlman, I think, was another.
Itzhak Perlman was another. But as it turned out, Isaac Stern had, I don't want to be subject to slander or libel. He was misguided. And was the irony of ironies, because it was he who had saved Carnegie Hall from demolition. That was the irony of that. And the greatest cellist in the world, Yo-Yo Ma, And Laurie Beckerman said when she got a letter from the Archbishop of Prague, what else could she do?
Right. So you don't think there was, do you think there were any compromises that could have been made with Beth Israel? Go ahead.
Yeah, Laurie did try very hard to compromise, just to keep the facade, speaking of facades, of the house. But they wouldn't move. They wouldn't budge. Mm-hmm. They made a show, which was obviously insincere, of buying the Salvation Army building I mentioned, which was half a block away. And then they said no, it was inappropriate. It was too far from the hospital. It was half a block away from the hospital.
Oh no.
Dvorak House is right opposite it, of course, is true. But I mean, you know, it was just real estate. But yes, Laurie tried very hard for a compromise, as did we. They weren't going to help. They knew. They hired Howard Rubenstein to their cause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest PR guy in the city. And they had pretty powerful people on their hospital board, of course. Of course, the irony, another irony, is that in the intervening years, the hospital itself is now in trouble financially, and it had to merge with another hospital, and their dreams of their real estate expansion dissolved. So it was all for naught in the end.
This is, you were saying, it was all mainly about them getting a foothold in that particular area.
Well, they have not expanded the way they had planned.
Right.
They haven't expanded, period. Mm-hmm. Well, they did. By means of a merger with another hospital, they did expand, but not in that area.
Right.
In Stuyvesant Square. They had already ruined Stuyvesant Square anyway.
Mm. What sort of citywide support was there for Luchow and Dvorak House versus like the Ladies' Mile campaign?
Well,
was it mainly a local concern for Luchow's
Dvorak? No, we had worldwide support. And enormous support for Luchow's ASCAP, the leadership of ASCAP. The Steinway piano people, because the original Steinway Hall was just opposite Luchow's, and William Steinway, who was head of the firm at the time of Luchow's prominence. Now I'm combining Luchow's and Dvorak House. Henry Steinway is the current Steinway, who got involved because when his grandfather, William Steinway, was running the firm, and the firm was right opposite Luchow's, and the Steinways would eat at Luchow's, but mainly because when Dvorak moved into the house on 17th Street, he was presented gratis with a Steinway piano. So we got the Steinway people behind us for Dvorak, and Luchow's for that matter. There's always been, generally, been more of an attraction for individual landmarks, or easier to build a constituency than for historic districts, because there's so many people who have access to grind in a larger area. But I don't know, to try to answer your question, I think we had an equal supportive behind us for all three of these mm-hmm. things that I was involved in, and others.
Even
as well.
From like citywide, like landmarks agencies.
You mean preservation organizations?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, and in most cases we had the political support too,
mm-hmm.
which counts.
Mm-hmm.
And except for Luchow's, we had the commission support as well. And you read the letter from the former chair.
Mm-hmm.
Of the Landmarks Commission that he wishes he had done mm-hmm. something about Lucha after the fact. So a lot of all this is getting as much support from every single quarter you can think of that's relevant, at least.
Mm-hmm. And were there any times you felt like you couldn't clash with the commission? Like there was a conflict? Like politically, they didn't think it was worth pursuing something.
Well, I suppose you could say we clashed with them over Luchow's.
Mm-hmm.
In fairness, though, as I guess I said, they did give it three public hearings, one for an exterior designation, one for an interior designation, one for both. But by that time, the rezoning idea had come along, and they weren't going to fight the planning commission and have a battle between city agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, all the fighting the commission in the world wouldn't have changed that. In fact, we did at one point, one of us said some very nasty things about the commission, which we had to retract. Not I. I won't let you know.
Okay. We won't have that on the record.
Yeah. You are going to be editing this, right?
Yeah. Will there be a transcript made that you'll be able to approve? Dad, look over it.
And including omissions, if I take it wrong?
I guess you have to talk to
huh?
I guess you have to talk to Tony and Vanessa and other people with the preservation archive.
Poor Tony has to go through all this and Vanessa.
Have you seen any change in developers' attitudes towards designation over the time you've been involved? No.
Not really.
They either see benefits or they don't, and to the designation.
They're congenitally opposed to what the Supreme Court has declared is legal. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's a handicap. Now, sometimes, as in the case of Mr. Taub and Ladies Mile, he finds it a blessing.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't many, in my experience, especially if they're so-called community facilities, like hospitals, colleges, schools, etc. And of course, the religious community is something else again, which is also not easy to deal with, and is very difficult for the commission to deal with, and so they try to avoid dealing with it.
I mean, do you think it's harder to argue for designation based on cultural than architectural value?
Sorry, what?
Do you think it's harder to argue for designation more based on the cultural value?
Oh, undoubtedly, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
This country, I'm sorry to sound so critical of my own country, but that's what we're up to these days, that's for sure. I don't think Americans, they're slowly coming around. But I don't think Americans appreciate their heritage in a tangible form as much as other cultures do. I think, you know, it's a gradual process. Mm-hmm. But when you consider that just given the city of New York and its five boroughs, only, I believe it's 3% of all of the properties in New York City are landmark. 3%? Mm-hmm. When we have one of the greatest cities in the world. And it would be outrageous in other metropolises. So it's the almighty dollar, as they used to call it. I don't know, some people, of course, you know. I'm expecting to be disagreed with by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm eager to hear what they are, what they say, but some people may not feel that that answer is a good one at all. But then I suggest they look at this, which shows after they're gone, people miss them,
yeah.
By which time it's too late. Oh, you said you had that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have loads of them. You know the Collier brothers? You ever heard of the Collier brothers?
I feel like I have, but I couldn't tell you what I am.
Oh, you are?
Yes. I grew up on Staten Island, and I've lived in Manhattan for the past dozen years or so.
Sorry. You don't sound like a New Yorker.
Thanks, I think.
I know, that was a compliment.
Yeah. Especially coming from Staten Island.
Oh, no, I think they know how to speak English out there. Well, where was I?
Collier Brothers.
Oh, the Collier.
Yeah.
Long before your time, and even before mine, there were a couple of very wealthy brothers, both bachelors, and who shared a house, a mansion that they inherited from their parents. And it was a mansion on Fifth Avenue in what is now, or what was then, Harlem, but it wasn't African-American Harlem then. They were both nuts. And they collected everything.
Yeah, I remember the story now.
One of them was found dead under a pile of papers. That's the way my apartment is beginning to look. So if I'm missing by the time you edit this, tell them to
look
knock
under,
on my
yeah.
door and look under the papers.
So what is your involvement with HDC, Ben? And how have you seen that organization evolve?
Well, it all started with Tony Wood, as most things do in this city. He, after the Luchas thing, I guess he asked me if I'd like to join.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was, yeah. And we were then, you probably know, in a basement in the Upper West Side, under the sufferance of the West Side Preservation Group called Landmark West, run by, I'm sure somebody will be interviewed in your oral history, Arlene Simon.
Mm-hmm.
Is she one of your candidates?
Yeah, I'm not that involved with the project. I'm just doing this through the class.
She should be.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a marvelous person, marvelous, but controversial, aren't we all?
Mm-hmm.
But she had a developer friend who owned a building and still does, and admired her and her work in preservation. replacement free of charge. And that's where HDC started, thanks to Arlene. And she's still in the basement. We moved to the second floor. So I think that's when I first got involved with HDC.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm almost sure it was Tony who talked me into it. Willingly.
Has the council changed over the time that you've been with it?
Oh, grown immensely. Mm-hmm. Immensely. I mean, we had one half-time executive director, barely paid at all, and now we have four full-time staff.
Mm-hmm.
And have made a name for ourselves, I think. I'm on the board, which is why I say our OUI.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll go further than that. I think we do now more for advocacy for designations than the other two citywide groups of note do, including Municipal Arts Society, where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Landmarks Conservancy. This is not a criticism of them, it's just that I think it's fair to say they branched off in other civic-minded ways, leaving to us the advocacy work with the grassroots and designations.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that the Historic Districts Council were named something differently. It's too confining. It says only Historic District.
Mm-hmm.
What about Lucha? What about Dvorak? What about any number of individual landmarks? Which we support, but I don't think have the fire in the belly for as much as we do for historic districts. If that's a criticism, so be it. Do you know, I am going to have to leave you for just 1 minute.
Oh, sure.
Be sure to clip that out. I should not have been drinking all that coffee and that water.
Okay, we're on again. So what were the key disappointments for you, or key accomplishments? Did any...
Well, the key disappointments are two, and they're
right
there.
Is, yeah.
Well, I'm proud of Ladies Isle. I think everybody concerned with it is. It was a fight worth fighting, and by the standards of some of the fights that others have been involved in, actually there's one I should tell you about in addition to that, but we published a book, I never even mentioned that, did I, called End of the Road for Ladies'
Mind. Yeah. They gave
question
me a copy
mark.
Of that, yeah.
You got a copy?
Well, it's a Xerox copy, but I don't know if it's all of it, but, yeah.
Well, we're down to their collector's items. We sold out. I have four left.
Wow.
Others I guess have some, but it's a rarity. Anyway, we published the book. We had the exhibition, the walking tours. All of these things help. And, by the standards of some of the time it takes some designations to get voted on affirmatively, Ladies Mile was, I think, about 6 years, at least in my participation it was. I don't think there was anything done in an organized way in the 70s that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think someone had just said that it had already been going on for several years. It was sort of a comment that implied that it had started a bit earlier, but
well,
it wasn't an exact date.
I don't think it may have been thought of, but I hope. But in an organized way, I don't think so. Mm. I mean, anyway, by the time I got into it, it was sort of underway, but formative, you know, it was just the beginning, I think, my recollection. And it took 6 years to get it. By the same token, I don't think I mentioned it, but in the same block as the Garden Life Annex building, which I did mention, and the Tammany Hall building, which we're still working on, the rest of the block of 17th Street on the south side, between Union Square and Irving Place, and around the corner into Irving Place, is 10 contiguous buildings, most of them 19th century, and the key one is the corner at the corner of Irving Place and 17th Southwest corner. People really did start trying to get those designated, or at least the key building, which was the so-called Washington Irving House. But that's always been debated historically, whether you actually lived there or not. But somebody who actually did live there and was famous was the interior designer Elsie DeWolf. Anyway, it took 14 years to get those 10 buildings contiguous, all owned by the same son of a bitch. Excuse me. SOB. You could wipe that or cut that out. But then he shot himself in the foot, the owner. There was a bay window on the Elsie DeWolf house, which was in very bad, all 10 buildings were in horrible shape. But this one was especially bad, and especially one of the bay windows. So he just waited for a summer weekend in the middle of the night on a Saturday, and he just shaved it off, the whole bay window, and put it in a dumpster. That did it. That got the commission action. Wow. Immediately they designated the whole damn building. So he really shot himself in the foot. But it took 14 years to get that.
Huh.
So that's another. It's a small historic district, but I'm very pleased to have been involved in that one, too. I don't know if that's in your script.
Whatever you want to mention. Did any campaign in particular mean more to you personally? I mean, I guess that one, maybe. Did any mean more to you personally of the campaigns that you've been involved with?
Well, it's hard to say because most of them have been in my area, so sure, I personally.
Yeah, they've all meant something.
Matter. No. I suppose Lucha's mostly, or mainly, or. But I love music, so Dvorak was important to me, too. But I think maybe Lou Charles was most gratifying. Not gratifying to be a part of trying to get it. Is that an answer?
Looking back, what particular strengths, talents, or perspectives maybe have you brought to the campaigns you've been involved with?
I'm glad I have a non-electric manual typewriter. That helped most of all. and postage stamps. Well, I think you'd better repeat that question.
What particular strengths, talents, and perspectives have you brought to the campaigns that you've been involved with? What point of view, perspective?
I suppose the fact that I play around with the English language helps a little mm-hmm. bit. My professional copy editor proofreader. I guess that helped. I wish I could say I'm a researcher. I'm not. Really, I mean, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, down deep and dirty research, the hard stuff, I rely on others. I suppose a certain amount of bulldog quality. A lot of scotch, the liquid that is.
Yeah.
Staying in one place for half my life, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason for that is I'm rent regulated.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd have moved years ago, or out of New York entirely. I don't know, a certain amount of respect for our American, and especially New York, heritage, architecturally, though I'm not an architect, or culturally, socially. I just hate to see good stuff going the way of all flesh.
mm-hmm. Do you think it's easier to get things preserved today than maybe a decade or two ago?
Not in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
No. The commission has been criticized, and rightly so, for, until recently, being Manhattan-centric. Ignoring the so-called outer boroughs, and they deserve that criticism. But now they are paying more attention, and that's fine. But the other side is that they're ignoring Manhattan by and large, which of course has the most designations, but
mm-hmm. nevertheless, most preserved too.
Who wrote this new book, The City at the Center of the World, The Island at the Center of the World?
I've just finished it.
Like it or not, this silly island is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
No. is there a direction that you see preservation going next? Or where you think
down
it should go
the
in
tube
the future?
Would that answer? I don't know. I think I once said ill-advisedly in one of the few times I've ever actually been interviewed. I mean at length like this, other than newspaper stuff, is that most people are preservationists at heart, only they don't know it until something like that expose comes out and they realize they've lost something. That's near and dear to them in one way or another, then they show their preservation colors. The problem is they should show them earlier than that. But it's so, the whole thing is so political that most people don't have the time or energy or expertise to get involved. I think a lot of them would if things were a little different. And if New York were not so obsessed with development, overdevelopment, or at least this borough.
Like the only thing left is there anything I haven't asked that you think is important to talk about that you'd like to?
Is there one?
Is there anything that I haven't asked?
Oh, like, well, how about Union Square?
Sure, go ahead.
Marcy will kill me for that, won't she?
Why?
Well, because Union Square is not a municipal city landmark.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really outside the parameters of what I guess we're supposed to be talking about. But it is, however, a national historic landmark and is listed in the National and State Registers of Historic Places, which doesn't give it much protection, but it's status symbol, if nothing else. And a lot of us fought to get that level of designation as well, which we finally got in 1997. We had no help whatever from the Union Square Partnership, the BID, Business Improvement District, nor have they ever supported any landmark designation in Union Square or nearby, ever. But what's at risk at Union Square now, apart from just purely on the historic preservation level? There are other things at risk, but for our purposes, it's the famous North Plaza, the site of soapbox orators, parades, rallies, demonstrations, every kind of political and social protest, including at the 2004 Republican National Convention, when the Parks Department wouldn't allow the demonstrators into Central Park,
mm-hmm.
on the theory it would ruin the landscaping. Yeah. So where did they come? Exactly where they should, Union Square. But there are many good things about the Bloomberg administration. I don't want to get political here, but he has not, to me, appeared to be sympathetic to preservation or landmarking. His so-called plan, NYC 2030,
mm-hmm.
plan,
yeah.
This is look down the
I can't remember
road.
The name either.
PLANYC,
mm-hmm.
2030. It covers every subject you can think of, except historic preservation and landmarking. And the other failure of his administration has been in the civil rights arena. And that brings up the North Plaza of Union Square, where it's my view that the plan to, quote, beautify it or gentrify it by planting trees and an elaborate pavement is not for beautification at all. It's to discourage public assembly. And I'd like to go on the record about that. Actually, the New York Times quoted me that way. I should have brought that too. So that's what I think is most at risk in the plans for Union Square. Much of what they've done already is okay. I'm not wildly enthusiastic about the redesign of the whole thing, but it makes some sense. It's amongst other reasons why the park is not landmarked as Stuyvesant Square Park is. because there's nothing left from the historical anything before 1930. There's nothing is left really, except the space, the vacant space. But their plans for others will find other reasons, and indeed my group feels there are more important things that are wrong, although they admit the whole thing's wrong in many ways, but they think the playground issue is more ill-advised. Mostly we all think the pavilion use is the worst part of it. The commercialization and privatization of a public building in a public park. Mm-hmm. It's unneeded, it's undemocratic. That's the way we feel. And some of us think it'll be injurious to the only structure that is in Union Square Park, the pavilion. My feeling is the worst element, though, is the North Plaza plan. And that behind all that is a deliberate attempt to hinder public assembly, for which the space is famous and for which it was federally landmarked. Is that enough for anything else? It's almost 6 o'clock. You probably want to get home. Yeah,
probably wrap things up. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. My goodness. Flattered.